This episode of The Jerdy Inning contains information from the following sources. Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets by Mookie Wilson and Eric Sherman. 100 Things Mets Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Matthew Silverman. Mets Journal, Year by Year and Day by Day with the New York Mets Since 1962 by John Snyder. The June 17, 1989 edition of the Philadelphia Daily News and the March 1, 1989 edition of the New York Daily News. Dirty Inning.
Hello!
Ha! See, I was ready for you that time. A show where we are really ironing out our opening timing. I am Justin Clue, the head guy at The Good Fight, and with me is Baseball Prospectus contributor, the sickened Dr. Trevor Strunk, currently battling an illness.
Yeah, I'm under the weather today, guys, which means you won't get my usual sparkling clarity.
you're gonna get our best stuff as always, but filtered in with a few sniffles and a sinus infection.
Slurp of chicken noodle soup.
You know, the kind of stuff you were prepared for when you downloaded this podcast. This is, of course, a podcast on which we talk about the most laughable, awful, or obscure innings in Phillies history. Really zero in on the moments that time, or perhaps you, have forgotten. We are, of course, a part of the Good Fight podcast family, where you've listened to other better podcasts like Hittin' Season or Continued Success. But this is a gem, I would say. This is our gem show on which we really not only just convey the history of this terrible sports franchise, but also the history of the city they play in, which we're going to get into today. Last episode, we talked about the first game in Philadelphia Phillies franchise history, which took place in the...
What a game it was.
In the 1880s, and we're going to stay in the 80s for this episode, but also simultaneously leap 100 years into the future. How is that possible?
What riddle is this?
I don't understand what's going on.
Now, reveal your strategies, wizard.
It's, of course... We'll, of course, be talking about the Phillies of the late 80s, which fans of a certain age to whom, you know, they are a golden era team. Not because they were, like, particularly good, but because that's just where a lot of, I've noticed a lot of our readers at The Good Fight, a couple of our writers, and just general fans, you know, they came up during that era, and people have a tendency to hold in high regard the era of baseball that they saw most as children. So I think this is going to be a sweet spot for a lot of people, and that's what we aim to do on The Dirty Inning. We aim to please, sort of, and then we aim to discuss.
You know, it is interesting, though, because I think, like, the 80s is a really good time to become a Phillies fan, because it's not like the late 80s Eagles were okay. You're pre-Randall for most of it. I don't know if 80, we're in 89. I'm not sure if Randall is there yet or not. I can't remember. But, you know, you're talking about pre-Randall. You have a decent defensive game, but it's not like they're winning titles or really competing. They had their shot in 85, 80, I can't remember, with Jaws, but didn't quite do it. And then, you know, the Sixers are not, it's not one of their golden periods. And the Flyers went in the mid-80s, but you know how the Flyers go. It's always... you know, have a good time and then have some misery. So, I mean, even though the Phillies weren't good, it wasn't like they had a huge, gargantuan competitor on people's interest.
Yeah, no, it's totally... The city was in one of its deader eras, I would say, for sports. We could certainly be corrected on that, but just taking a general overview of the sports scene in this town.
Can't believe we missed the Eagles' other championship.
Any particular? I mean, just take a scoop from any particular era, and you could generally say, like, yeah, the teams weren't really that good back then. But you kind of just got to put yourself in the position of the people who were streetwalking Philadelphia at the time, where, you know, for them, anything was possible. They're not looking back on this as a period of stagnant failure. They're looking back on they're looking ahead at it, thinking, you know, what's possible?
What's possible?
We got Von Hayes. You know, this team's really going to take off.
Oh, no. You know, I think about that a lot, and I don't mean to distract since due to my cold we are starting late, but it is do you ever think about the plot of Back to the Future 2?
All the time, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I knew you would. To me, Biff is like such a tragic figure, and I think it's because like I like sports. I can't imagine knowing the outcomes to sports games. Like can you imagine like just like knowing it all and being like, "Oh, well, they're not going to win this year even though it's exciting." Or like you're watching a close game and you're like, "Well, I know what the score's going to be."
A nightmare. In the broadest possible sense, like that sort of defines fandom, because we've just to make it about the Phillies, we've been watching teams that have not been very exciting the past couple of years, but you can get yourself, it is possible to just get yourself all hyped up for one game. Like, even when it's the middle of August, the Phillies are obviously out of it. Pick one of these seasons, they didn't really have a lot of even just singular players that you were excited to go see.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, if you have, like, tickets for the game that night, you can still, as a fan, just sort of be like, you know what, maybe they'll just win tonight, and it'll be, like, a cool, fun win, and we can just kind of, like, be fans tonight, not thinking about, like, oh, you know, they're going to lose this series, or the season will be over soon because they're not going to the playoff. Like, not thinking about any of that, just kind of thinking, like, tonight, we're going to a game, the team we like is playing, and perhaps they'll win. Anything can happen.
Yeah, I think about that a lot with, like, the interleague games, where I know that the Phillies will generally, you know, fall flat on their face because they just can't play interleague games. But, like, when they take, you know, two or three from the Red Sox, it's always like, oh, that's fun. Like, maybe they'll do that again, even if they're bad, even if they're good. Like I said, I don't trust them in interleague. But, like, you know, it's one of those things where I'm just thinking, like, yeah, they could do this, and that makes this one time watching the game fun.
Yeah, and you know what? It's always fun to beat certain teams, like you mentioned, and one of those teams is definitely the Mets, and that's exactly who the Phillies were playing on June 16th, 1989.
I have a feeling they didn't beat them.
They did not beat them, though they absolutely could have, because as we've learned, Trev, anything can happen, and tomorrow is not guaranteed, so you got to live for today, and I'm saying that because that's going to be an overall theme throughout this episode that somehow emerged. But Trev, before
you
we get to that,
recently, or
and I'm telling you guys, there's just got to live for tomorrow. It's all about today. Trev, before we get started, let me ask you though, what's the most selfish thing you've ever done?
that's a good question, Justin. Once I was at a show with my then girlfriend. It was a Tiger Army show. Probably most people don't know Tiger Army, but they were a sort of like psychobilly band from...
I got to cut you off right there. That in one sentence, you've not only done a humble brag about I've had more than two girlfriends, guy, and also you've condescended to everyone about your music tastes in a single sentence.
So well, it's what, not a condescension. It's that they.
I'm sure none of you have heard of Tiger Army.
Well, they're not popular. They didn't really make a mark.
Got to be really in on the music scene.
All right.
A lot of you are not. But what I'm saying is, please continue. I look forward to the remainder of this sentence.
Anyway, continuing this hell that somehow I am stuck with. So I was there with her, and she was also a very big fan of this band. And they had a, at the end, they were giving out the set list, which sometimes they'll do, like bands will do at the end of shows. I'm sure you've seen this, but like sometimes bands will do this at the end of shows, like to the people in the front row. Like it's basically like the simplest possible, souvenir that you can give. It's just like, oh, here's a sheet of paper we wrote out some stuff on. We were going to throw this out anyway, but it'll mean something to you. And I was there with her, and they put it out, and I pushed past her and everyone to get it for myself.
I love it. That's great. For me, I could think of, this is probably more self-serving than selfish, but I remember in college I was leaving a class, and there was a giant wave of people leaving the same lecture hall, and I happened to look down on the ground and see this wad of money just laying there.
Whoa.
And I kind of like it was such an amount of money that I don't know if you're like me. I've had dreams where I've like seen money on the ground, and then it's like a bunch of money on the ground, and you kind of have that instinct of like, this can't possibly be real. And
sure,
I had that
yeah.
same feeling looking at this money in real life. It was like, that is money, and it's not like a flyer that's meant to look like money or something. It's actual
real
money.
Oh, that's the worst.
So I'm like looking around at someone else who like looking for someone who is looking for money, you know, like you would do if you dropped a wad of money on the ground. You would just, I don't know, have that sixth sense to be like, oh, I lost that very important thing I had. And you're like looking around. No one was looking around. Everyone was just leaving. Everyone was just pushing away. And I was apparently the only one who saw it. I expected someone to yell when I bent down to grab it. No one said anything. I picked it up. And I just kind of raced home to my dorm. I was like,
I mean, who wouldn't at that point?
Counted it out. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it was $155, which isn't like...
It's not life-changing money, but that's a lot of money just to find.
As a college freshman to find on the ground.
God, how much beer did you buy with it?
You better believe all of that money went towards Natty Light. Absolutely. You know how many cases of Natty Light you can buy for $155?
I think it's around 15.
I would say, realistically, probably like 7 or 8.
Isn't it like $10.99 for a 40?
Yeah. I mean, I believe I was pricing it at probably like $20 in my calculations, which is, you know...
That seems generous.
For a case of like 30 beers, yeah, that's... I remember saying, like, should I have taken it to the cops? And my friends were like, if you took that to the cops would have that money. And you.
Yeah, that is that. I mean, I say yeah, but I would have thought the same thing at 18. But, like, that is such a dumb 18-year-old thing to say. Like, oh, maybe I should have given this to the cops. It's like, no, dude. Like, the cops aren't going to, like, do CSI to find out who dropped $115. Like, they're going to send this up the chain. Like,
right.
The major crimes unit.
Jamming it in his pocket. Yeah, like just putting it in his pocket. Like, yeah, we'll get right on that. Absolutely.
Vincent D'Onofrio's like looking at the money and thinking, like, who could have, what sicko dropped this?
But yeah, I mean, you know, everyone is capable of being selfish, I think, at some point in their lives, certainly in their younger days.
Not me.
Manager Nick Leyva was ready to call the Phillies selfish in 1989, Trev.
Wow.
In fact, he did after this game on June 16th. Leyva, some Phils are selfish, read the headline, which may have been the problem, as they had just gone through an 11-game losing streak that had only concluded when they ended a game with a tie due to rain. So not even the laws of nature felt it right for this team to win again after losing that much. They were 22-39.
It's the worst way to end a losing streak.
Isn't it? It's not by winning. It's just by not losing.
Not losing. Wow.
They were 22-39 by the time this game on June 16th rolled around, and they'd be an even 22-40 after it.
Ooh,
but
boy.
Something tells me if you lose 11 games, selfishness may play a factor, but it's not the only thing that's going on.
Oh, there's a lot of teams that are selfish. There's many players on the Oklahoma City Thunder who I believe are selfish, and they tend to compete in the NBA every year.
For some reason, that does not translate to abject failure. Yes.
Yeah, James Harden is known as somewhat of a selfish player, right or wrong, and he's working on his second MVP. So it seems curious that you would say that's the only problem, but I'm not Nick Leyva.
I don't think that, yeah, and I don't think that selfishness alone is going to tear your team down. It's certainly not something you want to see on your team. But alone, it's not going to be the only thing that tears your team down. To quote Danny Glover's character in Angels in the Outfield,
there's a thing called talent. They don't have it.
And Nick Leyva said something similar about his team after this game on June 16th. It's the pitcher's ability, he said after the game. They ain't got the ability.
Wow.
So what he basically was saying was,
this guy's a style, for sure.
We just don't have good enough players to win games, which it's the middle of June. They've already lost 11 games in a row. They're well under 500. They're buried in the division. You can't blame a guy for saying something like that, because that's something that like we at The Good Fight are saying about a team at that point when you're exasperated and you're just like, the team's just not good. They're just not good enough. They don't have the talent level they need to compete right now. But the manager typically in this day and age doesn't get to say things like that, especially
no.
Gabe Gapler, who's not going to go out of his way to say negative things about his team, even in the wake of such a devastating series of losing. But Nick Leyva, you know, different era, wasn't bound by that. And he just got to say, like, yeah, it's the ability. They ain't got the ability.
It's amazing.
And it was especially frustrating watching the Braves of late, who I believe at this point the Braves were still in the West, and it was just still the NL East and NL West, and the Braves were in the West. So they weren't even divisional rivals at that point. But
so who cares?
Watching the Braves, who had recently, perhaps the year before, but at least recently, promoted John Smoltz and Tom Glavine.
Oh,
watched
no.
them get shellacked, and then seen them morph into these effective future Hall of Famers. And Nick Leyva thought that maybe, you know, he voiced some thoughts that maybe something like that would solve the Phillies' problems the way it had for the Braves. He was like, maybe it's time to bring up a kid, let him get banged around, let him get experience. Maybe he'll learn something. But then he also said, in a complete contradiction of that idea, everybody who is deserving of an opportunity has been in and out of here. Basically saying, you know, there's nobody in Scranton right now at AAA that we're going to bring up who's going to save the day, even though, like, you know, that was one of the very specifically listed things that he mentioned that could help this exasperating team.
I love the idea of, like, of Sam looking at someone and being like, if only we had some Hall of Famers on this team.
You know, this team needs then a real... John Smoltz and Tom Glavine. Yeah.
What if we had generational pitchers on this team? What about then?
I keep bringing this up in the management exec meetings.
But, why don't you guys draft Hall of Famers more often?
Yeah, the Phillies weren't exactly giving out lessons on how to win. They won under 10 games in both May and June of 1989.
That's brutal.
There was nothing in Lee Thomas's farm system that was going to fix this thing. So it wasn't going to be a prospect. It wasn't going to be the manager. It wasn't going to be the fans. But we all know that in a season like the 1989 Phillies were having, as we said before, you know, there can be one moment, one pitch, or one, dare I say it, inning that turns everything around, that everyone looks back on as the critical pivot away from sucking all the time and towards maybe winning double-digit games in a single month.
But what if it didn't?
Yeah, but what this podcast posits is, what if it didn't? Well, maybe, Trev, maybe Bruce Ruffin could turn things around for the Phillies. Because, you know, Nick Leyva, as he told reporters, he didn't want to yell at his wife. In the recap for this game, it kind of ended on this point of, like, Nick Leyva knows, like, he knows he'll be at his breaking point with this team if he, like, snaps at his wife because of his, like, frustration. I mean, it's not in, like, an awful way, just in, like, a, you know, impatient, frustrated way. And he's like, he was saying, I don't want to do that. And I'll know if that happens that I'm out with this team. And he said, you know, he can't, because he knows he can't blame his wife. He says, quote, my wife's not throwing ball for her. She's not striking out with the bases loaded, but she might get a chance soon.
This guy rocks. I don't know. I don't know if Nick Leyva is the problem here. I think he's good. I think he is an excellent manager with the right kind of stuff.
I'm kind of with you on that. Like, he honestly, it's kind of really funny looking back at all these managers of some really bad or painfully average Phillies teams, and we're like, this guy rules. When clearly, like, if we had been fans at that point, we would have been like, it is time for him to be fired.
He rules because he says funny things. Can he help us win a game? Is there any way we can sort of parlay his comedy stylings into a win? Or no, nothing like that.
Once again, the forces of nature also on this day just despised watching the Phillies play baseball. Naturally. This game on June 16th, 1989, almost 3 hours of rain delays dotted this game. Three separate rain delays.
Can you imagine waiting through that? And being like, well, I came to the ballpark today. I want to see a game.
Yeah. And, like, having no real way of getting, like, regular updates as to how it was going. Like, they would probably, like, the closest thing to checking your phone to seeing, like, oh, they're looking to start this game, they'd put it, like, on the Jumbotron once they...
Probably have some sort of, like, 900 hotline you can call.
Right. Yeah, they get the readouts, and they're like, all right, walk it over to the Jumbotron guy, and he'll type it into the, you know, typewriter hooked up to a fuse box that makes that work. I have a good handle on what technology is like. But,
you know what typewriters and fuse boxes are. Watch out.
Almost 3 hours of rain delays. Just unbelievable. And one of them was 40 minutes before this game had even started, giving everybody an extra 40 minutes to stew in their feelings.
Good Lord.
Then the skies cleared, the lineups were read, and Bruce Ruffin trotted out to the mound for the top of the first. The people of Philadelphia at this point, Trev, still on the cusp of a new era in hair, in sports, in recreational drug use. The 80s behind them, the 90s in front of them, the sole bridge between the decades being Philly's own TV program, Dance Party USA.
Yay!
Are you familiar with Dance Party USA?
I know what it is. I never really watched an episode, but yeah.
Well, it premiered in 1986, went to 1992, so it's impossible to pin it down to a particular era. For the unfamiliar, this is a TRL-esque teen dance show that once featured Kelly Ripa, Bobby Brown, and in one clip I saw a man with a shoe on his foot as what? fashion dictator. A man with a shoe on his hand.
What insanity are we talking about here?
What? A man with a shoe on his hand. And it was shot in Philadelphia, which was why it's such a Philadelphia staple for generations.
Is Kelly Ripa a Philly person? I didn't know that.
That's a good question. I guess she has to have some sort of youthful attachment, right?
Bobby Brown is.
Yeah, so I would imagine yes. And I actually saw... Oh, she was born in Stratford, New Jersey, so...
Oh, kind of, then.
Nearish. I remember seeing the clip, like, everyone's like, the famous Kelly Ripa clip from Dance Party USA, in which she's gonna do a slow dance with, like, her prom date or whatever, and they would announce the people and, like, do real brief bios on them who are going to be doing, like, the slow dance on that day's episode of Dance Party USA.
Cool.
And I remember this so distinctly because, oh, man, it's so painfully lame. They're like, Kelly Ripa, and she's going to be dancing with her date, you know, let's just with Jeremy. And her favorite person is Jeremy. And Jeremy will be dancing with his date, Kelly Ripa. And his favorite person is his mother. Oh, Jeremy. Buddy, I feel like you had a pretty good opening there. And boy, you blew it. You just blew it.
It's a real shame because Jeremy could have, like, I mean, that's Jeremy has to be looking back and kicking himself a little bit.
Damn it.
She got super famous.
Poor Jeremy. I'm sure he went on to do great things. I have
Are
no
you
idea,
sure?
But no, I'm not. Most people do not go on to do great things. Well,
Justin,
what do you think?
I'm really starting to worry about you, buddy.
What do you think of when you think of Philadelphia in the 80s, Trev?
The MOVE bombings.
If you said anything other than a more organized infrastructure for proper waste disposal, you're wrong. In July 1989, Philadelphia was hard at work licensing and regulating its dumpsters so that at the time of lawlessness in regards to industrial-sized trash receptacles would finally be at its end. And that's why to this day, Trev, Philadelphia is renowned for its cleanliness and for its dumpsters being properly utilized waste collectors, and definitely not a breeding ground for our thriving and terrifying possum population.
Leave the possums alone.
Justin, I'll say it for the last time on this podcast.
They bring a lot to our city.
Alone. I used to live in an apartment in Brewery Town where we didn't realize it till after we moved in, but a possum lived in the wall.
Lucky you.
One morning, my roommate woke me up and was like, I think there's a capybara walking around behind my wall.
And wow, like, that would be surprising.
It sounded so, like, in the room. It must have been, like, through these very thin walls, and it just sounded so in the room that, like, we went into his room and, like, heard it behind the wall in one area and, like, moved a piece of furniture or something thinking, like, we were going to see an animal behind it. Like, that's how in the apartment it basically was. One
that
night,
rocks.
I saw the possum, like, climbing up a pipe and, like, pretty much just showing us how it got to our second floor.
Hey, guys!
And at one point, he was out the door when we went out to go pick up a pizza. And have you ever heard a possum, like, open its mouth and hiss?
Yes. It's a little terrifying.
Yeah, it's really a version of the worst you don't want to have to experience. They are truly disgusting creatures.
I feel like hanging out and playing with vermin is a very cool thing to do when you're a particular, like, level of age, though. Like, I remember when Kristen lived in, my wife lived in Chicago the first time when she was in college. She went to school in the suburbs, but they had, like, a study in Chicago program, so she did that for a semester. And where they lived, they had a big rat problem, which is not uncommon in Chicago because it's a, you know, major city. The girls, of course, did not like the rats. They tried to avoid them. I say, of course, because women are smarter than men at that age, quite a bit, and usually after that age as well. But the women did not like the rats. But the guys would tie food on a string and parade it around the backyard and said have what they called the rat circus, where the rats would just follow the food and chase it down. Which I think is pretty fun.
Unacceptable.
Sounds like something I'd like to do.
Just unacceptable? No. No. Absolutely not. I had a friend once who knew that a possum would frequent his garbage, and one time at a party at his house, he actually reached down and grabbed it. After enough beers, he reached out and grabbed this thing with his bare hands, held it up, and he's since deleted his social media account, so the picture's no longer available, but I can very clearly see it in my head that someone managed to take a picture of him holding this possum, and it's like open mouth snarling, and he is like opened his mouth and in like making like a ha-ha, like party time picture taking face. He's making the same face
insane as that the rocks possum. That rules.
And it is absurd.
What a truly, hero your friend is.
Truly disgusting.
Did he snap the possum's neck or did he just like let it live?
and then Trev, we ate that possum as a midnight snack. No, absolutely not. I don't know what became of it, but it's probably got a lot of people sick and then died.
Probably still alive.
Well, you know what isn't alive anymore is most of the possums from 1989. I know nothing about.
Way to bring it down, Justin. Jeez, I know nothing about bombing, but you killed these lovable mascots.
I know nothing about possum lifespans, but my guess is that they're all dead. But you know what? Indiana Jones was on his last crusade at the box office, Trev, or so we thought.
God.
And Star Trek sought its final frontier, which again was also a lie. Also, Field of Dreams was doing to the box office what it has done to baseball pop culture since it came out.
Ruin it!
Just sort of hang around forever, you know, in the background. Just like, I can see that anytime a baseball movie discussion is going on, even if you're making a point to not bring up Field of Dreams, you can just see that image of Kevin Costner on the front or the poster of Field of Dreams, like wearing like an open flannel and jeans, hands in his pocket, doing that kind of like... Ah, oh, jeez. Kind of like exasperated, put upon father look. That
was such a popular thing for a while, right? Like that look.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty basically what his entire career is based on. That sort of hangdog, whiny expression that he would put on, and then like reluctantly be the hero. Oh darn it! You know.
Well, good for him. I'm glad he was reluctant.
The summer concert season in Philadelphia was underway as Ozzy Osbourne and also the Bullet Boys had come through the Tower Theater in Upper Darby earlier in the month.
Kick ass!
I'll Be Loving You Forever by New Kids on the Block was in the air.
Boo!
Satisfied by Richard Marx asked Philadelphians through their window ledge boomboxes, "Why wait for some other time? There may not even be a tomorrow."
Cool.
Thank you for saying the word cool, Trev.
local
schools were letting out for the summer as well, including Cheltenham High School, where George H.W. Bush gave the commencement speech for some reason, a segment of which I will read to you now.
Oh, boo!
Let me assure you, I do remember how it feels, for it seems like only yesterday that I, too, was listening to a commencement speech at my graduation. Believe me, I wish it were only yesterday, but nevertheless. In school, I loved history and English, Major League Baseball, not necessarily in that order. But most of all, I loved the possibilities and horizons of the rainbow called tomorrow. A rainbow that here at this magnificent school, you color blue and gold. I gotta say, I feel like political speeches just, you know, back then... Really, just it kind of seemed like a bunch of stringed together nonsense. It's all very loose and like disconnected. Where did the rainbow come from?
Well, it certainly wasn't the Rainbow Coalition because he was actively denying that AIDS existed at that point. So it's really weird that they got the president to do this.
Yeah, it was a regionally famous moment that he came to Cheltenham High School to give that speech. I don't know why. I'm sure there's a reason, but I don't know why.
Probably some donor.
This month's issue of
cynical on the podcast.
This month's issue of Phillies Today, a periodical released by the Phillies, featured Vaughn Hayes under the headline "Versatile Vaughn," featuring the image of the outfielder using miniaturized versions of his teammates as the pieces on a chessboard. What message this was attempting to send is lost in time, but
Vaughn Hayes, super villain.
But in a city built on disappointment in professional athletes, Hayes will forever be remembered as one of the Phillies' most classic letdowns. On June 8th, 1989, about a week before our inning, Pirates broadcaster Jim Rooker made a fateful statement in the broadcast booth at Veterans Stadium.
Oh, I know this one.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I forgot about this, but I was familiar with it too. The Pirates had built a 10-run lead, and I thought that this meant Rooker was feeling confident enough to say this, but In truth, the Pirates were coming into Philadelphia at this point, having lost seven games, and they were really frustrated. They built this 10-run lead in the first inning, and Rooker's was thinking, you know, if they lose this game, I wouldn't want to be on that plane because the team had been getting really frustrated. Obviously, no one thought the Pirates were going to lose a game that they went up 10-0 in. So Rooker said if the Bucks blew that lead, he'd walk home to Pittsburgh. Well, wouldn't you know it, the Phillies actually got it together and came back to win that one. But Rooker, who was an honorable sort, did in fact, a few months later in October, walk from Veterans Stadium along Route 30 through central Pennsylvania all the way to the Steel City over the course of 12 days.
Wow.
And along the way, he and his friends had many adventures, coining the phrase 2 o'clock mad to describe the irritable fog they'd enter into the afternoon. They raised money for charities, including a children's hospital, and one of Rooker's friends who had MS, he raised money to be able to donate to him so that he could get like a van he needed to that had an elevator lift on it so that he could get his wheelchair into it. But yeah, there's some nice. pretty wild crap went down on this walk. At one point, he mentions Lancaster County, my hometown, that they had two of their most unpleasant days during fertilizer season, which I know very, very well. If you're going to visit Lancaster, that is a rough time to be on foot.
Man, I'm just imagining being out there, like, and you're all you're doing is walking, and it's fertilizer season. Oh,
at one point,
nightmare.
I think that they visited former ball player Sid Bream's mother, who lived in the area. She had a gourmet picnic set up for them when they arrived, and there was the fine wines and a violinist was there. Like,
thanks, Mrs.
Really
Bream.
Nice. Yeah, right?
Are you boys happy with your lemonade? Yes, Mrs. Bream.
But yeah, it sounded like quite a trip, and it's a hell of a story. And if social media had existed back then, that would have been
is there a book about it?
You'd think there would be. I'm sure
this has to be, right?
Jim Rooker's a very Larry Anderson storytelling, charismatic kind of broadcaster. He's known in the game, you know, one of those guys. So I'm sure
is he still broadcasting?
I don't know, but I don't think so. But if there's a book, I'm sure he's actually written three children's books as well.
Cool.
So, but yeah, that's if there's not a book about that or involving that, there should be.
I'm just loving imagining like a grown man going to a picnic. Well, boys, do you like the potato salad I made? It's the best, Mrs. Bream. You're so good at this.
Can we play on his Sega even if he's not home?
Well, of course. I don't think Sid would mind. Yay!
So the 1989 season for the Phillies had been colored by a series of hard-fought wins, but more punchless losses for the Phillies.
Cool. Sounds like another season I remember.
Many other seasons I remember, yes.
I'm just thinking of last season this time around.
June 16th would offer no answers as the team faced another deficit. But without any broadcasters tempting fate the way Jim Rooker had, the comeback would fall short.
That's a shame.
It wasn't 2 o'clock, Trev, when the game started 40 minutes late, but Bruce Ruffin and the Phillies were about to go a little 8:15 mad.
Ooh, all right.
Well, Trev, in 1986, Steve Carlton had gone from Phillies star to rotation liability, and the Phillies were looking for a sucker on which to dump him in his quickly fattening 6-plus ERA. That may sound a little cruel, but at 41 years old, Lefty just couldn't keep his fastball down. And he did still have the part of his career in front of him in which he'd jump from roster to roster a couple of times as a reclamation project candidate. You know, he wound up on the White Sox, I think, and the Twins.
Yeah, his post Phillies career is kind of like an interesting series of names.
Yeah, but he never really got back to effective enough to stay in the league. The Phillies released him on June 24th in 1986, and in his place was slotted a young arm from the farm system named Bruce Ruffin.
And he was going to be as good as John Smoltz, right?
Well, he's certainly left-handed. That is inarguable. Ruffin had a sinker that batters bashed straight into the earth for a lot of ground balls.
Well, that's good.
He put up great numbers as a 22-year-old rookie, joining the rotation after Carlton departed, but spent the rest of his career not reaching that high of a bar anymore. The southpaw could typically recover, but he always seemed to pitch himself into a hole in the season's first half. Now, by 1990,
that never fails. That's always a good strategy.
Well, what's interesting is by 1991, the Phillies got wise to this finally and actually sent him down to the minors for April and May and promoted him in June, resulting in one of his best seasons.
Did that work? He's ever
had. Just like, get it out of your system.
That's some Fangraphs comments shit. Like, yeah. That doesn't make any sense.
Nah, it doesn't make sense.
It's awesome. I love that it worked.
But this wasn't 1991. It was June 16th, 1989. And Ruffin was about to get roughed up by a Mets team that was just as worked up, pissed off, and tightly wound as the Phillies.
What a strange thing to have the Mets and the Phillies be both angry at their respective lack of winning. That never happens in the league.
You know, I kind of – this crossed my mind because now, basically, cliche comment to make about the Phillies and Mets rivalry is that it's lacking a lot of times in which the Phillies and Mets were good at the same time, which is true. But if you're true rivals, I mean, it's always, like we said earlier, it's always fun to get up as a fan for a game against the team that you hate and that, like, you know, historically sure. Your team hates. It's asking, you know, sometimes the new generation of Phillies kind of has to have their moment where they particularly dislike the Mets, or, you know, any team that it's going to wind up being is their rival, because it varies from generation to generation. We fans are watching the same team. The players aren't necessarily on the same team all that time, so they may not be as worked up playing the Mets as the fans are to watch them.
Right.
However, the Phillies and Mets are both historically, you know, underperforming franchises.
That's a nice way of putting it.
You know, like, they've probably both been equally sucky and frustrated at the same time. Which is probably an even scrappier and, you know, rougher time to play each other. So, like, that they were on the same level kind of contributes to their rivalry. But that sort of gets ignored because, you know, who wants to go back and read about fourth and fifth and sixth place teams? But, like, you know, that's a way to keep the rivalry alive as well. I don't know. I mean, am I off base here?
No, you're not. The games I remember the most, actually, out of and I mean, this isn't totally true. There are games that I remember much more, like the World Series games or the games in the playoffs. But some of the games I remember the most out of the Phillies' run of success in like the late 2010s or early 2010s and late 2000s, late aughts, is were the games against the Astros, because that's when the Astros really sucked. And they were also still in the National League, but they would always, always play the Phillies hard. And it was so frustrating. I don't know if you remember that, but they would always, like, it would be late season against the Astros. And be like, well, we got Halliday and Hamels and Oswalt and Lee all pitching. I don't think they were ever all in the same. Were they? Did we ever have all four? Was that ever a thing?
What, Halliday, Hamels, Lee, and Oswalt?
Yeah, we did.
You know we did, you psychopath. What's wrong with you?
Sorry, I sometimes forget because there was the dumb year that Ruben just traded Lee for no reason.
Yeah, but then he came back.
Are
you guzzling cough medicine today?
Yeah, I am. Sorry, blame that on the cough medicine. But the, you know, you're like, okay, four games set against the Astros, our four best pitchers, we should be fine. And the Astros would take three of four in, like, the stupidest possible ways. It's like, damn it!
Yeah, that was an annual frustration, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where it is still fun. You just might not... You're not going to get the national televised game slot when you're two bad teams, but it can be an experience to or satisfying to watch your teams play each other. So, but the Mets in 1989, they weren't doing much better. And, nobody illustrates that more than Mookie Wilson, who came up first to face Bruce Ruffin in the top of the first inning in this game. So it was 1989, remember? And in his memoirs, Mookie Wilson wrote that the 1989 season saw some events that, quote, really exemplified how the Mets had gone from a superpower to a team on the verge of self-destruction.
Goodness.
And that was, he's talking about the 86 Mets who won the World Series. And yeah, that was the Bill Buckner, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah, great team.
So in the span of a couple of years, they went to imploding, which Wilson was referring to a couple of events that had occurred to the team that year, starting in spring training. While posing for the team picture, Daryl Strawberry had refused to stand next to Keith Hernandez.
Yikes.
Hernandez had a habit of going on these long tangents, correcting Strawberry about whatever. And you know how likable and appealing those types of
now
people
I'm
are.
Now I'm suddenly I was initially going to be like, man, what a jerk Daryl Strawberry is. Now I'm pro Strawberry.
So when Strawberry wouldn't stand next to him, Hernandez called him a crybaby. And the next thing you know, they needed to be separated by the
weird
whole team, which I'm hoping, and maybe they're like famously are or anything, but I'm hoping that like it was picture day and they were about to take a picture. So I'm hoping that like a bunch of pictures exist of these photographers snapping
so
like
great
what was supposed to be like a team pleasant team picture, like turning into an all out brawl because two of them wouldn't stand next to each other.
Well, I don't want to stand next to him. Well, the reason he doesn't want to stand next to me is because of several things.
Let me explain why this was happening. Well, later in the season, two days after this game, in fact, the Mets and Phillies made a trade, which, you know, doesn't happen very often, but they made a trade 2 days after June 16th.
The famous Daryl Strawberry to the Phillies trade.
Not quite. No. The Phillies sent Juan Samuel to New York, and the Phillies got Roger McDowell and Lenny Dykstra.
Oh, well, yeah.
Phillies
auspicious trade. Yeah,
bounty paid off well not too long after the trade took place. The Mets got Samuel and immediately tried to turn him into a center fielder.
Ooh.
He wasn't one.
You could say a lot of things about Juan Samuel. He's a good player, but I don't, he's not a center fielder.
They tried again.
Goodness.
He still wasn't one.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. So, you know, these experiments with trying guys out at different positions. I mean, the Mets, they were kind of doing that. We're going to learn in a second here. They were shifting positions and trying to get a lot of guys on the field. If you know, that sounds familiar.
No,
there was a log jam in the infield. It was a weird time. And Juan Samuel wasn't really given his best stuff at this point. This was later in his career anyway. So same with Mookie Wilson, who was 33 years old at this point. All this time, Mookie Wilson was being kept out of center field because they were experimenting with Juan Samuel. Mookie was unsure of his role in the team, confused as to what the hell was going on.
Sure.
He asked to meet with management to get an answer. They just refused to give him a clear answer. Davey Johnson was managing the Phillies at this point. So miffed, Mookie Wilson calls his own press conference in the Mets dugout and just laid it out, verbalizing what I assume is the Mets franchise mantra. I'm pissed, this sucks, and I want to leave. They wouldn't trade him. They wouldn't give him answers. But finally, in late July, Mookie got his wish when the Mets sent him to Toronto at age 33. But tonight, June 16th, he was still a New York Met, and he unhappily singled to right field. I believe he was with them long enough. I remember having early 90s cards of Mookie Wilson on the Blue Jays. So.
Wow, did he win a series with them?
That's a good question. I'm thinking he wasn't on that team in 93.
Well, it would be kind of late. I mean, that's a pretty long career.
Yeah, he wasn't. He was traded to the Blue Jays in 89, and he was with them till 91.
Wow.
And his career is over after 91. Yeah.
Well, good for him though. That's a nice mid career. That's a nice late career renaissance, especially when he was so frustrated. I don't know why. I don't hate Mookie Wilson. Like, I feel like I'm supposed to on some level, but I can't really hate him. He's sort of like, he's one of those guys that was definitely a World Series hero, but just was never especially good after that. Reminds me a lot of like Pedro Feliz or something. Like, just the guy where you're like, yeah, he was who he was, and like we really needed him in the World Series.
Yeah, no, I mean, are we supposed to hate Mookie Wilson?
Well, he's a Met, and he won a World Series with him.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah,
I think probably yes.
Before my time, I mean, they won the World Series the year I was born, so I wasn't really I wasn't checking the box scores back then.
Oh, I'm Justin. I'm 1 year younger than Trevor.
Well, so with Mookie Wilson, you know, furiously standing on first base, Howard Johnson was up next, a man who replaced Ray Knight, a World Series MVP, at third base for the Mets after 1986. Johnson went back and forth being productive in even and odd years, but became beloved in the Mets clubhouse at a time when love was not a given in there. No point was this more evident than when Greg Jeffries arrived on the scene. And at 21 years old and a Sports Illustrated cover behind him already, he took Howard Johnson's job. Now, the locker room did not care for Jeffries. And from what I've read, not a lot of locker rooms had a lot of love for Greg Jeffries, regardless of where he played. He bumped out Howard Johnson, and it seemed like one of them had to go. But then the Mets, yeah, there was this sort of inevitability among everyone, the fans, writers, players. Everyone was like, all right, at the end of, I guess, like the 88 season, Jeffries is going to be made the full-time third baseman. Howard Johnson's going to be traded, and we'll all move on with our lives. But instead, they moved Greg Jeffries to second base.
Oh, no.
And Johnson was still around in 1989, a season in which he'd be an all-star, actually, and lead the league in runs scored. He'd actually be with the team for a guy who was expected to be on his way out. He'd actually be with the team until 1993, after the long assumption from everyone that, you know, his fate was sealed.
This feels in some ways like a weird mirror into the Phillies this year. Like,
it is.
Like, you could imagine a version where it's like Franco, like where Howard Johnson is. I mean, Franco's not the caliber of player, but like where Franco is a version of Howard Johnson here, where it's like, well, he's definitely gone, and then he's there forever. And like, and he strings together a couple good seasons.
Just reading about this team, it's just like, in your head, if you're somebody who's at all organized or who has ever like donated a bunch of your stuff, I have this like, they keep adding players and not getting rid of players. When are they going to start cutting the fat? When are they going to start getting rid? And I've said that on Hidden Season a couple of times, that I'm looking forward to the Phillies just having less players, you know, because then you have
you want the
less
Phillies
questions.
To be some Marie Kondo stuff on some Cohn Mari.
I just want them to have, like, you know, platoons are fine, but I just want people to like have jobs and know their jobs and know when they're going to play or know what dictates whether they will play or not. Like, and when you're just like, we have 9 infielders and 6 of them can play any position, so let's just see what happens. You know, why get rid of anybody when we can just keep compiling good or, you know, passable players?
Matt, does Cesar Hernandez give you joy?
A relevant and timeless reference.
Yeah, no one will ever not get that one.
Well, Hojo, as they called him, and who you and I will enjoy as a reference to a secondary antagonist from Final Fantasy VII, Hojo, as they called Howard Johnson,
so good.
Would give way to a one-out. He flies out, and that gives way to a one-out Kevin McReynolds at bat. A month and a half after this at bat, McReynolds would hit for the cycle as the Mets stomped the Cardinals 11-0. And a week after that, he'd hit a walk-off bomb against the Expos. He'd been traded to the Mets in 1986 in exchange for 4 other players, 3 of whom were also named Kevin. So that's weird.
Kevin trade.
The famous Kevin trade.
I mean, to be fair, Kevin was an extremely popular name for a little while.
Oh, absolutely. I grew up with like 12 Kevins.
Yeah, there was always like Kevins were the ones that had the well, you too, Justins would have them too. Where like it was the Justin K, right? Like you would have to have the last initial in there as well.
In my experience, Justin blew up as a name after I was out of I think there was starting to be a lot of Justins as I was in college, because first was Justin Timberlake and then Justin Bieber. So generationally, there were 2 of like the biggest pop stars that like people grew up with that they were like, I like that name, and then like, you know, gave that to their children.
It'll be like the various elementary schools in Philadelphia where a couple years from now where everyone is Carson and Nick.
Right, exactly. And all the dog, I can't tell you how many dogs I know named Chase. Like,
oh,
tons.
Sure, of course. No, that totally makes sense.
Well, McReynolds waited patiently while Ruffin fired a wild pitch at the backstop and Wilson raced to second base. All he would have to do was stroll there a minute later when McReynolds drew a walk. And then Daryl Strawberry worked another walk to load the bases with 1 out.
Did he have to stand next to Keith Hernandez at any point?
Well, Keith Hernandez was injured right now, so he wasn't factoring into any of this. But this brought everyone's favorite shrill-voiced 22-year-old to the plate.
Hey, guys!
Greg Jeffries, according to many, once seemed destined to be a generational player but just never adjusted to playing in New York. Now, Trev, I saw this repeated multiple times, and I gotta ask you, because I don't think I do. Do you consider playing for the Mets playing in New York?
No, not really. I don't consider. I mean, I don't. Let me preface that by saying I don't buy that playing in New York, if you're like a generational talent, is really going to ruin your ability to be a generational talent. Like, I think probably you can play anywhere. Yeah, I guess like, you know, if you're Zach Greinke, you may have like anxiety, and that might, and like, you know, maybe that was what he had, but it doesn't sound like that's the case from what you're saying about him. I guess that's a dangerous assumption. But even saying that, no, I would consider the Mets basically. I mean, the Mets are always like the second tier team. They're not ever really, they never get the same attention as the Yankees.
That's what I mean. Like, when you say that, when somebody said, like, oh, you know, he never adjusted to playing in New York, your first thought is, oh, he played for the Yankees, which is, like, the most covered, highest class organization in baseball. So
right.
Playing in New York, playing for the Yankees, I get why, you know, that is different than playing for, like, the Padres or something. But the Mets, you know, they play in Flushing. Like, yeah, they're called the New York Mets. And, you know, they are a team that gets coverage. They're an East Coast big market team. But at the same time, never adjusted to playing under the harsh spotlight of the New York Mets. Yeah, I mean, I guess you could get easily trashed, you know, in the headlines as a New York Met. But it's more just like people are waiting to trash. Like, it's more normal, you know? Like, with the Yankees, it's like, we expect the most from you, and we will be hard on you if you are not the best.
People expect you to fail as a Met.
Right, exactly. Like, they're second tier team in New York, and they just are. So, I don't know, man. If you are a generational talent, and that gets scuttled because you played for the Mets, I don't know if you were ever a generational talent, and I'm not ready to excuse you just because you played under the harsh spotlights of Flushing. Like, I don't buy it.
The same thing. I mean, like, it would be like if you said, "Oh, yeah, like, you know, he was ready to be like a generational talent, but couldn't handle playing under the spotlight of the Jets."
Like, or like or the Islanders.
Yeah.
That popped into my head. Like, yeah, the Islanders are technically a New York team, but, you know, they're not one of the teams. You're like, oh, are you man enough to play for the Islanders?
Like, I don't know, probably.
Well, Jeffries would finish third in the Rookie of the Year balloting in 1989, and even though he only hit .258 with a .706 OPS, he was really up and down. In 40 games and 156 plate appearances in April and May, he hit .187. In August and September, he hit .309. So
yeah, .309.
And don't forget, he was learning a new position, sort of. I can't stress enough how much everyone thought, again, Howard Johnson was going to be traded and Jeffries was going to take over third base, because not doing that, moving Jeffries to second base, created other problems. Because Tim Tuffle...
You're kidding. Moving someone to a position that isn't their normal position created other problems? It wasn't a perfect solution?
Well, there were two other guys who were trying to play second base on the Mets, and then they threw Jeffries into the mix there as well. Tim Tuffle was one of them. He'd been with the team since 1986. He was ready to make a serious push to take over second base, having assumed with everyone else that was going to be an option for him. But he didn't get it because one of the team's third basemen did, and resentment of this spilled out immediately. It came out immediately in spring training.
Shocking.
The New York Daily News was writing a story just about, like, March 1st, so right around the beginning of spring training. And in Port St. Lucie, everybody, you know, there was already tension. So they were talking about these the double play drills they were running with the second baseman, with Tim Tuffle, another guy, and Greg Jeffries, of course. So they just keep running these double play drills over and over and over and over and over again in, like, the midday sun, and they're, like, exhausted. And it was like, why are they hammering this home so much? And Tim Tuffle says in the New York Daily News, obviously these drills weren't done for my benefit. And as the writer goes on to say, he was talking about Greg Jeffries, who had been handed second base by manager Davey Johnson's decree. The attention Jeffries receives is so lopsided. One player remarked, when Davey Johnson and the coaches were doing those drills, they hardly even looked at Tuff and Keith Miller. Everything was for Greg. Like, that is
wow.
That is brutal. Tim Tuffle called it the worst situation of my career. Again, March 1st.
seems like it might not be a great year for the old Metropolitans.
Just brutal. Like, what a decision. Ah, by the end of spring training, the Mets ownership was insisting that Jeffries wasn't playing out of position and that he had just made so much progress. So they were backing their boy, and Jeffries wasn't anybody else's favorite person. So when he smacked a ground ball up the middle for a single off Ruffin, knocking in Wilson and McReynolds, you know, yay, but at the same time, boo.
Yeah, everyone was like, I wish he would be bad at this, so yeah, we could get him off our team.
Yep. So Dave Magadan, another infielder in the whirring blender of a depth chart the Mets were currently sporting, stepped in, and he, too, was rewarded for his at-bat with a wild pitch from Ruffin. This one allowing Daryl Strawberry to score and making it 3-0 with one out.
Feels like this Ruffin character is not so good.
I'm feeling like he's gonna be having a rough one out there today. I feel like the Mets are really roughing him up.
Yeah.
Hello? Did you hang up?
No, I'm here.
Oh, okay, great. Dave Magadan doubled in Jeffries.
Oh, roughing him up!
Oh. See, you got there. We get there. We get there on this podcast. Yeah. So Dave Magadan doubles in Jeffries, and at this point it's 4-0. A runner on second, but thankfully a ground out by Barry Lyons allows Ruffin a second out. So next up was Kevin Elster, who was playing shortstop for the Mets that day, and he was a recent casualty of the aforementioned blunder as well.
Are you kidding me? How many players are they just, like, throwing to the trash for Greg Jeffries?
Well, it's
incredible.
I don't know, unbelievable. And it's refreshing how blatant and honest these players were about their frustrations. Elster, according to the Daily News, had been considered not too long ago, quote, one of the most well-rounded prospects the Mets had spawned in years. And yet, here he was, battling Johnson, Maggot, and Jeffries, and don't forget Keith Hernandez, who was injured at this time, Tim Tuffle, Keith Miller, all of them for playing time.
Jeez.
And Elster wasn't getting it, and the lack of consistency may have been playing a part in his steadily dropping numbers. And like Wilson, Elster blamed the manager, Davey Johnson. I guarantee you, with most other clubs, I'd still be out there, 24-year-old Elster said, but Davey loves offense. He's won that way, so I can't argue. Johnson said that Elster was suffering from a lack of confidence, something his whole lineup was that was victimizing his whole lineup.
I wonder what could have helped with that.
I mean, come on, you know, Elster's weak ground ball to third base wasn't exactly a slump buster during his at bat, but it was somehow enough to score Magadan, and the inning continued thanks to Elster. So what was left?
Why four bats, Davey?
four straight singles, of course.
Oh God!
David Cohn started the barrage in what everyone watching probably had assumed was the last at bat of the inning. Is there a name for when a pitcher's first appearance in a game is as a hitter? That's got to be something.
Got to be,
right?
A cone.
Nice. well, the thing was, Cohn was a hitter. He hit .234 in 1989. He didn't have any homers, but he hit a pair of doubles and had 4 RBI and only 13 strikeouts and 77 at-bats. That's that .234 batting average, by the way, higher than the ones that Daryl Strawberry, Juan Samuel, and Kevin Elster would finish the year with.
Goodness gracious. What happened to Daryl's cocaine? I'm so sorry.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, he was in the throes of his drug problem, absolutely.
I was going to say, whatever happened to that guy? Like, we all know what happened to that guy.
Cohn singled to keep the inning alive, and then Wilson, Johnson, and McReynolds all followed suit, batting around, each with an RBI single. It was 8-0 by the time Ruffin left the mound in the top of the first. There was then a rain delay of 1 hour and 54 minutes, and Ruffin went back out after an almost 2-hour rain delay.
Why would you do it? It wasn't like he was doing... That's just punishment. At that
point, he threw 10 pitches. He walked 2 batters, and then he hit the showers, the indoor ones.
Wow, that's amazing!
Unbelievable. Why?
What a truly loathsome thing to do to your pitcher.
So this game was an insane back and forth, actually, that ended after 2 a.m. The Phillies came out and scored 5 runs off Cohn after the Mets' big first inning. Randy Reddy greeted him with a solo shot to lead off, so he was certainly ready.
Oh,
the Phillies went ahead 10-9 in the fourth inning with a single and a pair of RBI groundouts.
Wow.
So, you know, go down 8-0 in the first, they're up.
Come back for a lead. That's not bad.
A spry 28-year-old John Kruk made a magnificent diving catch on a line drive that everyone loved. But the Mets used errors, stolen bases, and some key knocks to get to Phillies reliever Steve Bedrosian, who one writer compared at this point in his career to less to bedrock, as was his nickname,
sure,
and more to quicksand in the 8th and 9th innings.
Eww,
and the Mets went ahead for good, taking a 15-11 win. The same score that, by the way, the Phillies had beaten the Pirates after going down 10-0 in the first inning. So it wasn't uncharacteristic of them to battle back in games like this. So I bet
cool.
You're thinking, you know, why didn't we talk about that game where the Pirates went up 10-0? And the answer is because I didn't see it until I'd already started researching this one. So
because the Phillies won. I mean,
but that is how the Phillies fell on June 16th, 1989. Not the worst affair ever because they actually made a game of it. But that first inning must have just been an absolute slog. Just
I mean, was Bruce brutal. Was Bruce Ruffin, like, how long was he in the league after this?
I feel like I owned a lot of Bruce Ruffin baseball cards when I was a kid. He was in the league till 1997.
What a depressing thing to own, Justin.
That's like almost touching, you know, the modern era that we talk about today. He made it to the late 90s. His career was 12 years long. His, as I mentioned, his 1986 rookie season at 22 years old, he had a 2.46 ERA in 21 starts. And, like, that's pretty good. Yeah. He got some rookie of the year nods. After that, he had three straight seasons where his lowest ERA was 4.35.
That's not good.
He dipped below four a couple of times, but he stopped starting games. He was very, very irregularly starting games by 1992, and by 1994, he wasn't making any starts. So he was just purely a relief role with the Rockies starting in 1993.
Oh no!
So
early
'90s
Rockies. That's where you end your career.
Yeah,
that's tough.
And he stuck with them too, is the amazing part. Goodness. But he finished a lot of games for him. So, yeah, he finished 137 games with the Rockies over 5 years during their fledgling stage. So he was around for a while as they were getting off the ground. But this was, one of his early career performances. Did not go well, but does serve us well on the Dirty Inning, on which we talk about innings like this. We have in the past. We will continue to do it in the future. So make sure to join us next time on the Dirty Inning when we will have another terrible, just somehow interesting, but also just very disgusting inning of Philadelphia Phillies baseball. And don't forget to subscribe, download, and rate our other podcasts as part of the Good Fight podcast family. We've got Hitting Season with John Stolness, Continued Success with myself and Liz Rocher, and of course, Dr. Trevor Strunk and I here on the Dirty Inning.
Hitting Season. This is Hitting Season featuring me.
This is the official rebrand of Hitting Season. We, of course, appreciate you listening, and we look forward to bringing you more episodes like this in the near future. So thanks again, and we will talk to you next time on the Dirty Inning.
Bye.